Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Will.
I'm not sure if this is a first for Blogging Heads TV. This is an international episode. You are way on the other side of the world in New Zealand. Is that right?
That's right. In the South Island of New Zealand.
In the South Island of New Zealand. So what city is that you're in? I know.
The city is called Christchurch. It's one word here, and it's the largest city in the South Island of New Zealand. And the university I'm at is the older of the universities, called University of Canterbury, and it's probably famous for having people like Karl Popper and John Pocock here, and at least on the art side.
Oh.
So it's got a tradition of doing sort of political theory and things like that.
Excellent. We're glad to have you on from, and I know it's no small thing to. What time is it there? It's 5 p.m. here in Washington.
It's just after 9 in the morning on a rather damp spring day.
Oh, well, goodness. Well, not a bad day to be inside recording a dialogue. Well, for those of you who don't know Professor Francis, I'm going to hold up the cover of your book on the screen. He's the author of a recent book called Herbert Spencer and the Invention of Modern Life. Here's the cover with a handsome picture of Spencer. People just don't have facial hair like that anymore, do they?
No, all these Victorians did that after the Crimean War, really, and because the soldiers got frostbite in Russia, in southern Russia. So
that's what it was.
There was
to
a hole.
Keep you from getting frostbite.
It was a fashion adopted from the Crimean War, and people who were old fashioned later in the century still wore the kind of mid-century hair.
Amazing.
And also Spencer, who was slightly radical, as you probably guessed, He felt that one should challenge. It's a bit like a 1960s fellow. You should challenge convention by doing what you could with clothing and hair a bit. It amused him to sometimes challenge convention. Though in those facial hair things, he's pretty ordinary for the time.
Yeah. So what got you interested in writing about Herbert Spencer? He's not really in the mainstream of thought these days. So,
well, I kind of thought of myself when I was younger as sort of a real pro. So I thought I'd take on a hard topic that hadn't been done, and I worked on it for a long time, and did a proper research job, and that was that. I ended up knowing a lot about, say, metaphysics and psychology, and then somebody said to me, which I thought was a convincing conversation I had with somebody, who, like, why is he interesting?
Mm-hmm.
And that's more than a professional question, Will. Like, it's not just it. And so, and I initially found him difficult to admire. Like, initially when I was put off by some of his personality characteristics, I started looking at them quite carefully to see which attributes he put on to deliberately shock people, and which were sort of fairly normal Victorian habits, which were genuinely eccentric.
Which aspects of his personality did you find off-putting?
Well, I think his consistent sort of goody two-shoes attitude, like his worrying about goldfish suffering, his consistent cries of pain when he was disturbed by any domestic altercation, anything like this, was he couldn't cope very much with verbal conflict and so on, and. That was difficult, and also when I first started doing the science work, I found that I read quite a lot of history of science and mm-hmm. history of anthropology and evolutionary thought, and it didn't seem to fit any of the common explanatory patterns that were being used. Like basically as if a whole third or half a century had dropped off the map.
Yeah.
So reconstructing them was interesting.
Yeah, I have to say, like reading your book, it was actually really quite difficult. I read a lot of difficult texts, but I found it hard to understand Spencer's views because they didn't fit into any of the sort of patterns of thought that you're used to hearing about. It seems like a completely different thing that seems kind of exotic or foreign, even relative to the other 19th century thought with which I'm much more intimately acquainted.
Well, I guess I kind of, like as a professional historian of political thought, I don't think one should be a dog in the manger, you know, like seize some hold of some material and fend off all comers by mm-hmm. saying that they... You know, there's a lot to be said for using old texts, and I quite like some American scholars like Jacob Levy used Montesquieu recently, which I thought was kind of interesting. And the thing that I didn't like about a lot of the origins of liberalism texts and comments on Darwinism and so on is that basically they'd become very narrow sets mm-hmm. of commentaries that didn't do much for us, and they weren't accurate either. So I saw myself sort of faced with two different tasks. One, getting it right.
Yeah.
And then when it came to politics, I made a bit of an effort to not be controversial, but at least dust up a few people that were, I thought, too narrow and dull.
Yeah, well, I find the parts of the book on how Spencer challenges the sort of prevailing wisdom about the sort of the nature of liberalism and the origins of liberal ideas is fascinating, and let's get to that in a minute. But before that, let's get a little bit into Spencer's background for the listener's benefit. So Spencer comes from what part of England?
Well, he comes from Derby, which is perched right on the boundary between the Midlands and the north of England. And it's a it's the city of Derby where he came from was started off as a village, and during his life, it was during the Industrial Revolution, it grew into a sort of a ramshackle town or small city.
Mm-hmm.
The politics was radical. Everybody was a would-be merchant prince, capitalist, inventor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place with egalitarian politics, not much class division. His own background wasn't very religious. His father ran a scientific institute in the town, so he went to chemistry lectures at the age of 10 and
mm-hmm.
so on. He liked to think of himself as self-educated because he was very proud of being original, but he was very well educated by his father, who was a professional teacher.
Mm-hmm.
His uncle was a teacher. Both his uncles that influenced him were both teachers. He was taught probably as carefully as somebody like John Stuart Mill, maybe more so.
Really?
Even though he prided himself as sort of coming out of nothing. He
mm-hmm.
came out of a complex, intellectual, scientifically minded background with a bit of radical politics involved.
So I found that as sort of an interesting mix. So like John Stuart Mill or somebody like that had a very rich education in the classics, the history of philosophy, as well as the sciences. But it sounded like Spencer's background was sort of almost exclusively science with then whatever the kind of prevailing moral ideas were in the sort of cultural milieu. But he mainly had a scientific background, wasn't that well-versed in classic literature or classic philosophy. Is that right?
I think he could have been. Yes, that's right. One of his uncles, who was responsible for his education, was a classicist and usually taught classics, but the uncle and the father agreed that they had an educational philosophy that wouldn't force somebody to do something like classics and would let him follow his own head in mathematics and science. And he always had a sort of a modernizing streak about him, and it wrapped up in his politics, too. Like, classics was a preserve of people going to private schools, or public schools, as they're called in England. And so it was an aristocratic preserve. As a middle-class radical, it was something you should avoid. Like, there was a combination of desire for scientific learning and a desire to resist the tyranny of the past. Mm-hmm. And he was quite strong-minded when he was young. So he had the opportunity of doing classics, and mm-hmm. he wasn't forced. He was permitted to develop as he wanted.
So what
which
were
was unusual for that time?
Sorry, what was Spencer's first major intellectual work in? What was the subject that he tackled first?
Well, as far as I can see, it was politics. He was working as an engineering surveyor as a mm-hmm. young man, and he was very full of himself, and his father challenged him to see if he can do better than some now forgotten mildly radical political philosophy text, and he said, certainly I can, and he wrote something on the limits of the state for a radical newspaper at the time, which was has been reprinted as part of a book recently. And I guess his first serious efforts for about 10 years were in writing on politics. And he lived in the, after he sort of partly grew up and started looking after himself, he graduated from being a railway engineer to working for the Economist newspaper, which was quite a famous, it still exists, but it was at the time sort of a radical anti-corn law free trade sort of newspaper. And he was a sub-editor for that.
The magazine that calls itself a newspaper, I like, is by some people. Well, it actually happens, I write for the Economist's economics blog part-time.
Well, you're an inheritor of Spencer.
Yes.
You and he was before Walter Badgett, and he worked for a man named James Wilson, who founded the newspaper, and he worked with a very famous economic theorist named Thomas Hodgkin,
uh-huh.
who's probably underread now.
Yeah.
Spencer was very much into engineering, economics, and so on, but he chose to write later mm-hmm. on other subjects.
Let me back up a second. Badgett, that's how it's pronounced?
Yeah, I'm afraid it is.
Okay, because
when I was an innocent Canadian before I went to be educated so finely in England, I used to say Bagot, but I'm afraid it's Badgett.
Okay, because I've never known it. I didn't know if it's like Bagahot or Bajot or something like that. Thanks for clearing that up. That's that's helpful. So Spencer was worked as a sub-editor on The Economist, which has which at the time had very free trade-y views. I guess it still does.
Radical politics. In those days, to be pro-merchant, pro-industrialist, mm-hmm. was to be radical, mm-hmm. because politics was, to a large extent, still controlled by the upper classes.
Now, time span would have this been?
Well, in the end of the 1840s,
early 50s.
And Spencer worked after that when he did a second big politics book, which was a very radical book, which was influential in the States, called Social Statics. And he was a very what you'd regard, I guess, as a left wing figure, but I don't think left wing and right wing makes a lot of difference in this period. It's too confusing to be helpful. He was a land nationalization advocate.
Mm-hmm.
Because who owned the land? The aristocracy.
Right.
You know, it was unjust, and so on. And that book circulated from about 1851 till the late 1860s, and was very popular in the United States, and mm-hmm. a cause for embarrassment for Herbert Spencer later, because he didn't want to be associated with these doctrines.
I think probably what most people, when they think of Spencer, they have a number of there's a set of associations people have with Spencer. One of the things that people have heard about him is sort of Justice Holmes's famous quip in the Lochner case, that the 14th Amendment does not enact Herbert Spencer's social statics, which I think has helped consolidate Spencer's reputation as a kind of radical laissez-faire type. But that seems to be a misconception. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a misconception. What he was probably getting at, I like Holmes. I mean, mm-hmm. who could fail to like that man? But Spencer, and by the way, there's been lots of good American scholars on Spencerianism in America, starting off maybe as early as Philip Viner, the guy who edited and founded the Journal of History of Ideas.
Okay.
His major book was on the American Spencerians, mm-hmm. really, and people like John Fisk and so on. And the reason Spencer was loved in late 19th century America wasn't really his politics. He was viewed as a kind of a philosopher who could give people a really good sense of cosmology in a non-religious world. You know, so there was and because he believed in altruism, good outcomes, which he had in Social Statics, mm-hmm. as well as in his later works, lots of Americans who liked an optimistic philosopher at the time took him up and extended on his ideas. And they say John Fisk was probably the biggest figure. But this has been written, and also people in the Smithsonian, ethnographers, all sorts of people mm-hmm. read Spencer for different reasons. And he was very influential in the States, not just for his politics, but for other things.
Okay, I think something you mentioned sort of brings up, I think, probably the other biggest misconception about Spencer, which I think we should try to get out of the way, which is that because you mentioned that Social Statics actually is in favor of a certain kind of optimistic altruism, but Spencer's often associated with a kind of like devil take the hindmost laissez-faire social Darwinism. Usually in sort of casual intellectual conversation, he comes up as being an advocate of sort of like, let the poor starve because if they're not making it, they don't deserve to. Now, how badly does that misunderstand what Spencer really said?
I think that does seriously misunderstand him. I mean, it's historically there's a bit of a link and a bit of confusion. He had mutual friends with Charles Darwin. He met Charles Darwin at what passed for a cocktail party in Victorian England. Darwin explained his theories to him. This is before The Origin of the Species. And by this at that particular time, Spencer was a snappy sort of journalist. Mm-hmm. And Darwin explains his theories. And he said, if I was you, Mr. Darwin, I'd call it survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
He didn't use it himself. He gave it as a quick phrase.
Oh.
You know, he was writing. He was writing for a living.
Yeah, yeah. And, it's a good phrase. It's had legs.
And it had legs.
Yeah.
But his own theories in his biology, which I must be one of the few people who have read seriously, though there's Robert J. Richards at Chicago who's very good at on Spencer science.
All right.
His own theories were not survival of the fittest or struggle theories. And later, when his psychology, which was fairly tough in the first edition in the 1850s, his Principles of Psychology, mm-hmm. which was his major academic work before he did his system, he did say things that could be and were construed, especially in France, by French social scientists, as kind of racist. He went to a huge amount of trouble in the 1870s to expunge all these things from his psychology and from his sociology, and make sure that people couldn't use survival of the fittest ideas in social conflicts. In human conflicts, like he tried to make sure they couldn't get scientific backing from these ideas, because the problem with Darwinism isn't Charles Darwin in mm-hmm. terms of social Darwinism. It's that journalists only took up one phrase, you know, from the 1850s
right.
and 60s, and they just bandied the one phrase around. I mean, there was very little scientific backing, at least in the English-speaking world, for this. It seemed like a nice thing to defend almost anything, colonial wars, whatever. You know, survival as a trade unionist or a merchant
right.
capitalist or something, and obviously Spencer was very appalled by this. He actually thought that competition, as an excessive work, was a bad thing. And I suppose you noticed that disastrous visit he made to New York, where he told the assembled business elite of New York to not work too hard.
How did they respond to that?
They were appalled. They almost didn't publish the text. You know, it was It was an embarrassment for his supporters. And
now, what was his rationale behind? Why did he think that it was bad for you to work too hard?
Oh well, because he was disagreeing with John Stuart Mill, mm-hmm. and who had been had given a famous address as the rector of Edinburgh University, mm-hmm. Saying what you should do is that you should live to work, and Spencer reversed that and said, no, you should only work in order to live. You know, many of my friends have overworked, it's done them a lot of harm, and he blamed a combination of capitalism and religion, you mm-hmm. know, sort of a Weberian, not that he Weber was writing yet, but
right.
it was sort of an anti kind of labor thesis. Laborious lives were very bad ones. This was his own. That's why, going back to your initial question, mm-hmm. the reason I talked about his life is one to clear up misapprehensions, but also I came to the conclusion that his autobiography, rather than being an instant text, was actually almost a philosophical work indicating what his ideals were at the end of his life, like. And where he'd gone wrong and things like this. And
yeah,
one of the
you relate that he painstakingly sort of like wrote and revised and edited his autobiography to shape a very yeah. particular image of himself for posterity.
That's right. And he also tried to say, don't be like me,
and
which was, you know, like it was.
Now,
in
which respects was he worried that people would be like him, like the overworker? Because one of the things that I found interesting about the book was how peculiar a guy Spencer was. So he seems to have had a hard time sustaining sort of close personal relationships. He was kind of famously had a short relationship with George Eliot. But you suggest that, for all we know, he died a virgin.
Yeah, well, I think that... Well, I mean, one can't. I said probably. One can't know these things for sure.
Sure.
I think that he was first and foremost, I think, a psychologist. He spent an awful lot of time analyzing himself and why he did things and whether he was happy or not and so on. And he had some beliefs, faulty ones as it turned out, that if he had got married, which he didn't get close to as far as I can see,
mm-hmm.
that he would behave like his father, who was a domestic tyrant, a good man, but a domestic tyrant. So he thought it would come out genetically. And so he had to avoid such an outcome. But later, I'm not sure how serious he was about this, because by the time he got to his 30s, he thought basically he was too rigid and spoiled for such activities. Like his friends, Victorians were not really open, but they did talk about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, why don't you exercise? Look, you're getting migraines. Why don't you have conjugal affections? and he would say, good idea, but it's too late for me. Mm-hmm. Plus the fact that he had a small inherited income.
Huh?
If he had a wife and family, he'd have to go back and work as a journalist.
Mm.
He had enough to live somehow until basically fairly late in his career. His books made enough for him to live comfortably.
So
it was kind of a decision to go for intellectualism rather than the normal family life, whose absence he always regretted, of course.
Yeah, well, it's there are, you know, today there's still trade-offs. It's it takes a, you know, at least then you had to support your wife. That's something mm-hmm. kind of liberating now, in the sense that you don't have to choose whether or not to get married depending on whether or not you're going to have to support your wife. She might be able to support herself. But you know, children are the same. It's the same idea. You still have to, you know, if you probably are going to have a lot less leisure to do what you like if you have, you know, a brood of six to support, right? So,
well, he made those sorts of calculations, and mm-hmm. I sort of, I don't know whether he was eccentric. I kind of eventually felt, maybe I'd worked on him too long, Will, but I eventually felt he wasn't that unpleasant at all. Like, I mean, like, I don't think the job of an intellectual historian or an intellectual biographer, whatever I describe myself
yeah.
as here, is to transfigure somebody or disfigure them. You know, you're
sure.
supposed to make it interesting, but and plausible,
mm-hmm.
but I actually felt that he went to huge amounts of trouble with his friends. He mm-hmm. was very clubbable. If you put him on a boat trip, I described one of his tourist holidays,
yeah.
with some people he didn't know very well, you'd get very remarkable outcomes. and he didn't. And he was difficult in some ways. Like, he courted fame.
Yeah.
And when it came, he was appalled. You know, like, but actually, I find that rather amusing.
Yeah.
Rather than.
Oh yeah, I mean,
you know,
through your book, I could sense the your affection for the guy. I mean, his peculiarities come off as endearing foibles rather than as any kind of a warped character or anything like that. So, and I also found him sort of charming and likable, and wanted to talk to him after reading your description of him. He seems like a lot of really interesting people, a lot of really brilliant people, are a little bit weird around the edges, but that's partly what makes them so fascinating and good to have at a party. So,
yeah, and I guess he was a bit on the vulnerable side, and that made him. Spikier and more self-protective than he should have been. He certainly, the contemporaries were slightly worried about him, but very fond of him. So, he retained his friends, which is a good sign. With a person, I mean.
Let's talk about his major works briefly, and then move on for the rest of the time to talk about some of the most interesting parts of his. Political and social ideas. So was his first major work the work in psychology?
I guess the first major work, not an academic or technical mm-hmm. one, was Social Statics.
Social Statics.
Okay, about 1851. Mm-hmm. Yeah, about 1851, which was a piece of radical politics that comes out of that just after the kinds of radicalism that accompanied the anti-corn law free trade agitation, and it was also a very optimistic time in British and European politics, you know, despite the revolutions of 1848, which England really didn't experience.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of dampened the ardor for optimism in Europe, but not so much in England. Okay, so it was an optimistic time. Then he sat down, and I explain how this happened, but he sat down and wrote his Principles of Psychology, which was taken very seriously at the time and was considered a fundamental work in evolutionary psychology in his time.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the mid-1850s. And so those are his first two books. And the next one, if I mention the next one, that'll launch me into his philosophical system.
Mm-hmm. Great.
That's the First Principles. And that was the one that, it was from First Principles onwards, that he started picking up lots of readers in places like the States because he seemed somehow to speak to people who had wanted to find a modern meaning for life in science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I, as you can see during the book, I make play on life as life in biology, mm-hmm. but also modern life in sociology and also the alienating qualities that life is supposed to have for modern people.
Yeah, so
which it certainly did on him.
Yeah, so what is let's talk a little bit about some of his scientific views. In my and the sense that I'm a very kind of analytical guy who likes to break things down into little parts, and I noticed that that Spencer has a very very a kind of grandly holistic sense of things, mm-hmm. and so I felt like his view was kept being a little bit elusive to me, like because it was, you know, everything's related to everything else throughout the system, and humanity's evolving, and the animal world is evolving, and the whole universe is kind of evolving, and it's all related, but I couldn't ever quite figure out exactly how.
That's a brave and difficult question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me think. If I was a Spencerian philosopher rather than just a mere historian of political thought and so on, let me think how I'd deal with this. I think that if you can imagine, instead of a motivating force being struggle for survival, mm-hmm. you know, natural selection.
Yeah.
He instead of that, let's say your basic idea was borrowed, not directly but indirectly, from economists of the 18th century. Adam Smith, I'm talking about here,
okay.
of course, and it was filtered through a European natural scientist, and it was basically that evolution proceeds by specialization,
mm-hmm.
And this happens in the animal world and it happens in the social world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like it's basically the idea of Adam Smith's idea, you know, of factory and industrial evolution, you know, that
mm-hmm.
one gets more specialized tasks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Spencer basically thought living organisms, which he included social organisms here, developed by specialization. He also
sounds good.
He varied
so far
on whether he had it. Yeah, and there's a split, which he didn't notice, but I did,
uh-huh.
between his biology, which is anti-teleological.
Right.
It's a perfectly good piece of natural science. Evolution for animals is not goal-focused, okay?
Mm-hmm.
To say it's goal-focused means you're part of some Platonist kind of old-fashioned science.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're dealing with human beings, and you're talking about human society evolution, even though people's plans are usually not successful, you know, you can't ignore that people have plans. Like, in other words, there is a bit
right.
of goal-focused evolution in his sociology. So he didn't notice that his notion of evolution had shifted from his biology to his sociology because, well, he never read his old stuff.
Well, that's one of the reasons why it's hard to distill a coherent view out of his writings, partly because there isn't one, that his view developed over time. He kept refining his thoughts, and some of his later thoughts seems to have
yeah.
contradicted his earlier ones, which is what a good empiricist does, or what a sort of intellectually honest
person
does.
Yeah, that's right. And it's because if he had been a philosopher in, say, a Cartesian model or
mm-hmm.
something like this, this wouldn't have happened.
Right.
But because he was imbued with empiricism, basically, he just followed the facts, and, you know, or the low-level discussions in some area of, say, botany or anthropology or something like this, and came up with the best possible findings. And that makes a messy theory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is a philosophical theory to some extent. It's not. He is a philosopher of
right.
science and a philosopher of social science. And that's one of my quarrels with some of my history of science colleagues, is that they think he's some sort of inadequate professional scientist, which is kind of odd, because none of his contemporaries thought it. They just went to the same clubs, you know. They had their own private X club. They talked in the Athenaeum about who was a really good scientist,
mm-hmm.
you know. But Spencer was a philosopher of science. He was sort of a fellow traveler with scientists.
And he was trying to create a kind of framework to help systematize all the work that was being done in the, you know, in the current cutting edge science at the time.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And now
it struck me reading the account of the biology even though he doesn't have a strongly teleological idea in his biology, there does still seem to be a progressive element to it. That there is a kind of there's definitely a kind of systematic change over time, and it seems progressive in that he seems to have somewhat moralized conception of nature. That there's a role for ideas of cruelty and things like that in your descriptive account of biological processes.
Yeah, that's a good observation, Will. I was trying to bring that out. I mean, and it is actually a hard one. If you start off at, say, about 1850, believing that there's sort of a natural goodness in the universe, and as you read more and more scientific data about parasites and
mm-hmm.
parasites existing on dead animals,
yeah,
and dinosaurs with giant teeth and claws and so on. All this information coming in.
What kind of God makes that universe. Kind of stuff? Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And a benign universe is harder to maintain. And in a sense, he was responding to his contemporaries in trying to synthesize a view of the universe that would somehow give some hope. Like, in one way of looking at a lot of Victorians, especially, say, people like Darwin, is they felt very bleak about the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Spencer basically was the opposition here. He invested the organic universe with meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
and you said that's the source of his popularity, is the idea that he gives you some sense that despite the fact that there might not be some personal God watching over all of us, still the universe is somehow arranged in a way that tends towards harmony and peace and something like that.
That's right. And he had readers and influence. You can see some of his ideas come out in popularizers like H.G. Wells, mm-hmm. after, you know, in science fiction and things like this. He had some idea that human beings were centered in the universe. Like, in other words, their evolutionary prospects were important,
mm-hmm.
you know, even though there was no direction by God, you know, like no fulfilled, no,
right.
no plan. So that was a matter of genuine significance for him, as well as for his friends and his readers. I mean, now that's a hard call then and now. I mean, how do you invest the universe with meaning?
Yeah, I mean, I think cosmology. It's a key part of the debate. We keep seeing these debates between people like, you know, Richard Dawkins and Dennett and people like that who are giving naturalistic accounts of religion and things like that. And the objection is that they leave us with a universe that is bereft of any guiding meaning. And it's still obviously a point of view that lots and lots of people struggle with, and that is one of the and remains one of the main impediments to people being willing to accept a naturalistic conception of the universe overall.
That's right. And Spencer, as if you compare him with, say, really powerful 19th century atheistical figures like Renan, the Frenchman,
mm-hmm.
he had been a clerical person, a monk, I think, mm-hmm. rather than a priest, but. And he'd become an atheist,
mm-hmm.
you see. Like, he'd gone from belief to total disbelief. There was no middle way for somebody like that.
Yeah.
With Spencer, basically inherited this natural theology tradition,
mm-hmm.
except God winked out and the universe still meant something to human beings. So that's, I guess it's still a current debate. I mean, it's hard to say now. I mean, we now have a war between science and religion,
mm-hmm.
as has been pointed out. That war really didn't exist in the 19th century. Like, the historians who said there was a war between science and religion in the 19th century were faking it. But now we have a warfare between science and religion.
Yeah.
Now, whether there's a place for an intermediate figure now, I don't know. I express skepticism at the end of the book about that,
mm-hmm.
whether we still have a middle place. But I protected myself by pretending I'm only a historian at this point.
Well, let's move on.
I didn't have to take sides.
Hmm? Yeah, well, you can be Switzerland in this debate, right?
Well, also, I kind of think writing about a person as complicated as Spencer,
mm-hmm.
and seeing which things are going to last and which things weren't, I don't control the universe. If I had been controlling the universe, I would have had Spencer's philosophy of classification right up there, which I thought had real legs,
mm-hmm.
and was really good stuff, and it's very similar to what current scholars are doing.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was very interesting stuff. But frankly, the people who are doing it now don't use Spencer. They just do it on another route, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Where I thought his politics and his humane politics and his way of dealing with issues like the importance of privacy in our society, you know, how we should protect various things,
mm-hmm.
without a choice or democratic mechanism, I thought was interesting.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that a little more. So, in one of the things you stress in your chapters on politics is that that Spencer represents a fairly conventional Victorian political attitude that is that you can justifiably call liberal, but it doesn't seem to match up with the received wisdom about what the essence of liberalism is, which rests in a very strong idea of individual autonomy and rights. And so you say that Spencer gives us a good example of how to ground liberalism apart from individualism. Can you explain that a little more?
Yeah, I think I wanted to, that's actually, I did decide to, as you probably noticed, get out slightly outside the historical mode when I did that chapter, as you probably noticed.
Yes.
But I was trying not to be polemical. I was kind of feeling feisty by some fairly thin scholars who were talking about the origins of liberalism.
Yeah.
And they're mostly philosophers, and they don't really care about origins, and I don't know really why they did those books. But and it seemed very flat what they were doing. Mm-hmm. Now, I think one of the problems in current political philosophy, as is taught in the academy, okay, is that quite a few people, not just in political philosophy departments, international relations, all sorts of areas, are really Kantians,
mm-hmm.
which is fine. And I would think Kantianism gives a very good moral philosophy and has very little to say about politics. You can always defend yourself as a Kantian
mm-hmm.
in moral terms, but there's no politics at all. Now, despite people like Hayek and so on coming along and mentioning politics occasionally, quite a lot of current so-called political philosophy by people who call themselves liberals aren't really associated too much with the liberal tradition which they try and cover themselves with. Like it's a very thin reading of John Stuart Mill to claim that he's only about choice
right.
and that he doesn't have a role for the nation state and so on, which he does lots of ways. So I was basically just trying to not get rid of John Stuart Mill, but get rid of a cripplingly narrow notion of the foundations of liberalism. So. Which, by the way, and it's kind of primitive work, a lot of these people, because if the foundations of this, therefore we should be like that, which is kind of very odd.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't actually, it's a genetic fallacy or something.
Yes.
I think. But I didn't want to write a book on liberalism. I just wanted to clear some space
mm-hmm.
on what we think are liberals. I mean, and where we should go. And I thought there were some things to be said. That were interesting.
One of the ideas you mention in this vein is the in Spencer is the primacy of justice and equity over the individual. And can you say something about what Spencer meant by justice and equity?
Well, instead of justice being, say, with John Rawls,
mm-hmm.
okay, which I know you know quite a lot about, Will,
mm-hmm.
instead of it being a matter of something perceived by the individual making choices, you know, before you set up a society,
sure.
With Spencer, justice to some extent has to take into account the evolved social institutions that we have,
mm-hmm.
right? Spencer was perfectly happy with institutional evolution at the same level as individual evolution. And so we had this sort of a set of traditions, roughly similar. If Spencer had been an American, he would have had a constitutional fetish, I think.
Yeah.
You know, he would have thought that the American Constitution was a really great thing, an evolved, articulated machine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the thing to do in politics is to keep the machine from crippling individuals because sometimes we have unintended consequences, like the fact that we have a sense of private life, which we do, and we did in Spencer's time, when it was fairly new, is something, a vital thing we have to protect. It wasn't designed, it just is an extra. it now becomes part of the institutional fabric's duty to protect things like people's private lives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's actually something significant to say. I mean, there's no choice Kantian basis for this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a product of institutional evolution.
Yeah.
Now, this had been noticed by other 19th century people, of course, but they thought it was all going to be wiped out. Like, in other words, the unintended goodness of byproducts of constitutional evolution, like liberty.
Mm-hmm.
They thought, a lot of people like Hallam, the constitutional writer, thought this would just wink out. Like, we had these nice things. They were unintended. They, as we modernized the state, they would disappear.
So why is it that but Spencer seems to have a view that through the process of social evolution, certain kinds of he uses the language of utility, even though he doesn't really like the sort of like hedonistic utilitarians, but he seems to think that social mechanisms, so you know, traditions, norms, various practices that have utility will be selected and preserved, and not just get wiped out.
That's right, but I mean, I think maybe excessively critical about one of your countrymen's efforts on Spencer, which I always regret if I'm excessively critical. Well, I feel bad afterwards.
But, I almost never have regrets about being excessively critical. Must be a different personality type.
Well, there are various kinds of species of political philosophy animal roaming around,
mm-hmm.
and if they're too much in their species, they're kind of uninteresting. And some of these are Kantians, I've already mentioned, and some are utilitarians.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're even harsher as a fanatical group than Darwinians or something, you know. Now, I kind of think that Spencer was pretty systematically anti-utilitarian,
mm-hmm.
Because basically he had a strong bias from his youth, which a lot of radicals did. That utilitarianism was a pig philosophy. Like, it was just too low.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what he shares with utility is hedonism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he personally wasn't much of a hedonist,
right.
But he thought it was a good plan. He thought we should be. Probably also why he was popular in the States.
Yeah. Well, from my reading of your account of it, it seems like he was a kind of asymmetric hedonist, that he seemed way more concerned with the reduction of suffering, like cutting out the bad part, than he was about maximizing the good part. Seemed to be...
Okay. I think, that's right. Okay, but if we had to deal with Jeremy Bentham, Bentham would be happy about that, because pleasure and pain trade off quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
But he also, the problem with dealing with this utilitarianism, it only works if it's an intergenerational long-term gain, and Spencer was very suspicious about that calculation. In other words, you should suffer pain now for somebody else in the distant future would get some benefit.
Right.
And he always resisted that.
So it sounds like he foresaw some of like Derek Parfit's arguments, right? If we all lived at just a subsistence level right now, so that we could save up a huge amount of money that would benefit three times as many people a few generations hence, then we ought to do that.
And Spencer was very deeply suspicious about such arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, in fact, they were tantamount to advocating cruelty,
mm-hmm.
Which for him was the worst thing you could do. One of the reasons he isn't really utilitarian is that he's a different kind of moral philosopher. He insisted on going for certain kinds of virtues. I tried to do a bit of thinking. I wasn't very successful outside this framework about where Spencer would fit with virtue ethics.
Hmm.
I don't really like virtue ethics people, because they always seem a bit slow.
They
always only talk.
They seem too serious
Aristotle.
To me. Yeah, like Aristotle.
And yeah, and they always only think of Aristotle. But and I kind of wonder why certain virtues come in and out of existence, you know. But I mean, yeah. With Spencer, Spencer had a person with virtue, you know, like this, the end game is we all evolve to more virtuous people, right? But it's also clear to Spencer that if you take some, and he eventually started using the word pre-social to avoid being harsh and racist, like using words primitives, like a lot of his contemporaries used words like primitive, and he tried to talk about pre-social people. And he liked certain people. Everybody likes then and now Pueblos. He liked Pueblos. He liked Indian hill tribes. Mm. And he would look at these Indian hill tribes, and he would say, look, it's quite obvious in certain virtues they're better than the more sophisticated Indians around them and better than the British around them, like in the Indian Empire in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
They actually have. They're kinder, they're more honest, you know, they have these sets of virtues. Now, the end game is we're all like them. Now, there's a evolutionary problem here, Will.
Right.
Like, if they're pre-social and they have these virtues, okay, and more virtues than we, more developed people, have now,
mm-hmm.
So what he thought was that basically we were going through an unvirtuous evolutionary phase, which includes us,
mm-hmm.
as well as, and at the end game, and this is a utilitarian calculation, there'd be many more virtuous people around.
It's kind of,
you know,
it's kind of like
the virtues would be same.
You know, an idea of like the man resembles the child, right? And we're going through a kind of adolescence here, so.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And so, but the virtues weren't, some of these virtues weren't going to evolve. Now, this is a tricky issue in terms of his evolutionary thing. And some of our virtues seem to evolve, or at least some of our social goods.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have them before. We now have them. But some basic virtues are the same. They're just, the evolution is there going to be more abundance in the future. Now, that isn't, I don't know what to do about that. If I was writing virtue ethics, I'd worry about this a lot. But fortunately, I have a life that means I don't have to write about virtue ethics.
Yeah, fortunately. I want to ask you another question or two about the the role of custom and tradition in Spencer, and one about the nature of rights in his theory, if there is any role for rights. You describe Spencer as a certain kind of paradigmatic Victorian liberal, but he has this very, very strong idea about social evolution, the importance of custom, preserving traditions that play an important social function. Now, a lot of people would think of that as just a typically conservative view. What's different about that than, say, Burke or who, like Michael Oakeshott later on?
Well, I've had the pleasure of meeting Michael Oakeshott, or met him once, and he taught my teacher, so, you know, but I'm not an Oakeshottian or a conservative. I just thought, and I wasn't sure that Oakeshott was either, but he... I'll give you Oakeshott as a conservative.
Okay.
Burke, I wouldn't give you as a conservative. Now, look, I made some comment in the note that there's a parallel between Bagehot and Spencer. And one of the now either very elderly or maybe slightly dead Bagehot commentators who did, I thought, really botched his analysis of. He was a Tory, an English Tory.
Mm-hmm.
Botched analysis of Bagehot by calling the greatest liberal journalist of the 19th century a conservative because he had a notion of tradition. And I did my best to deal. I have some good notes, Will. I did my best to deal to this man in one of the notes.
Mm-hmm.
And Spencer, oh, sure, I noticed that Spencer looks a bit like Bagehot and like Burke.
Yeah.
Okay. And has a notion of tradition because. You can't really talk about the sort of cake of custom, the accumulated wisdom that exists in legal or political institutions without having a notion like that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I'm sorry, we're getting overlap from the distance. Worth noting that perhaps, you know, one of the greatest liberals of the 20th century, F.A. Hayek, had a very complex theory of social evolution and the importance of tradition, but he had to write an essay called Why I Am Not a Conservative, specifically to contrast himself with people who are willing to somewhat uncritically accepting of whatever prejudice happens to bubble up from the past.
I actually think that's a good comparison. I quite admire Hayek myself, both as a scholar and as a political thinker. I know he's a troublesome figure for American conservatives. I once reviewed a book in which, critically actually, which claimed that Hayek was not conservative enough, was still a liberal, and which I thought was fine. I thought that Hayek is a considerable thinker. And he does have, not all his scholarship points in one direction. Some of his straight scholarship, like his study of Mill, was a straight piece of scholarship. But I actually thought that the parallel between Hayek and Spencer is about as close as you can get. The Burke thing is a little bit different. Going back to Burke, you know, you're talking about the sort of custom tradition notion. Because even though Burke's fairly complicated in this issue, Burke's later thought, like the reflections on the French Revolution thing, which is where most people start, is actually a vision of the need for a very controlling state, and no voluntary things underneath it. Because that's the way we are. Burke just thinks we're sort of a flabby species that need a lot of help. I kind of go along with that that recent Burke interpretation that indicates that he actually had a sea change before the French Revolution and had given up any toleration for dissenters and wanted a church-state alliance and all this sort of thing. He was, in some sense, a good ancestor for conservatives, Burke. I mean, I'm not... where Spencer isn't like that. His notion of tradition is very protean, and it's just part of an evolutionary theory, and I think it's no accident that he and Badgett had similar notions here. And Hayek's specific interests, like his desire to stop the state from being corrupted and so on, is a very different set of interests than Spencer has. But the parallel's good. I think that's a good parallel between Hayek and Spencer.
Yeah, we're running a little short on time, but I think one thing I'd like to do before we stop is to try to locate Spencer a little better on along some axes that people care about in contemporary politics. So one of the things that is sort of remarkable about Spencer is his sort of indifference to democracy. He's not anti-democratic, but he's not like a big democracy promoter either. Can you tell us something about Spencer's kind of complex relationship to democracy?
Well, I guess, and picking up the question I didn't answer you asked before, Spencer doesn't have a rights theory, so there's no kind of way of going from a rights theory into democracy. I think the problem that Spencer has with democracy is he doesn't have the normal Victorian belief, and I think it was fairly normal, that education is necessarily progressive.
Okay.
Like, he's open on this one, and he's fairly skeptical about this. So he doesn't have the sort of John Stuart Mill idea that if you educate the masses, they will be less reactionary, more open to intelligent debate and so on. So Spencer isn't quite clear what's going to happen when you educate the masses. He's skeptical about this. So he basically thinks that we'd be better on to rely on our evolved political institutions and not go for rapid changes. Again, that's making him sound more conservative than I'd like, but there's nothing I can do about this in terms of where he sits in the present set of 21st century political cleavages, you know? He does sound a little bit more like a 21st century conservative, even though he's a 19th century liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But on that issue, anyway, I can make him sound more progressive on other things.
Like, what, give us an example of his sort of most progressive view.
Oh, his anti-aristocratic prejudice doesn't matter very much right now.
Right.
But so his consistent anti-imperial views,
mm-hmm.
which would impact now. Like he really doesn't believe in any tutorial mission that we would possibly have. The fact that we're more progressive, more advanced than some other society, doesn't give us any way of interacting with them. Like, in other words, in trying to interact with them, we just become worse ourselves. We don't actually improve them, and we probably disfigure ourselves. So he has a very strong anti-imperial mythos that would be much the same in the 21st century as the 19th.
But when you talk about, like, interacting with other peoples, could that be construed more broadly than just in imperial terms, like the function of the World Bank in helping the developing world get better rates of economic growth? Would that be like a kind of interpretive?
I was thinking more of the imaginary duty we have to make people into a constitutional state or democratic state or something like this.
But what would his attitude would be to other sort of like non-military kinds of, because I understand that he didn't think that we do a great job of, you know, say like remaking Iraq into a liberal democracy.
I think he would be fine about that. I mean, in some sense, Spencer has to be seen, like Hayek is, in mm-hmm. my view, a deeply pragmatic figure.
Yeah.
Like, he is distrustful of very large organizations, whether they are states or large enterprises. They're the only thing we have. In other words, we have to have these large organizations, but they should be constrained in various ways. And one is they should be constrained in politics. They shouldn't actually intervene politically outside states. Most interventions, imperial inventions in the 19th century as well as now, have been done on the grounds that the local place is a failed state.
Mm-hmm.
Failed state terminology didn't exist, but the reality existed before. So therefore, we're obliged to do something. Well, Spencer said, no, we're not obliged, and what's more, we cannot do these sorts of things. We're at a different level of political kind of sophistication. It can't be transferred. In a way, he was not like a kind of a primitive Republican or something like this. Like, you can't just transfer the Republic somewhere else. It just doesn't have the right social structures and so on. I guess that could be seen as progressive.
Mm-hmm.
His views on education were and probably still are progressive. Insistence on avoiding cruelty, like having a constraint in all your public actions against any cruel outcomes, could be seen as progressive.
Now, that actually reminded me, strangely enough, of Richard Rorty, who's recently departed, has written a couple essays about just how cruelty is the worst thing that people do to one another. And he tried to build his sort of pragmatic politics around the idea of just being against cruelty, which doesn't really tell you that much, in terms of, policy guidance. But I was kind of surprised to find myself in my mind drawing a comparison between Herbert Spencer, who's got a bad reputation for mm-hmm. being indifferent to suffering, and Richard Rorty, who's saying cruelty is the worst thing that there is. So that was one of the things that really highlighted to me how little I really understood Herbert Spencer's thought from the inside.
I was attempting to recently to write a paper on what one could do to current political philosophers and if one could modify them using a sort of Spencerian evolutionary set of ideas, and had a reasonably good time with this paper. Haven't published it yet, but it's not a historical paper.
How would you modify them?
Well, I kind of thought
that eyeball in the middle.
Well, I thought that if one had an evolutionary synthesis, mm-hmm. and had some, you couldn't actually, you don't have a predictive factor. Okay, you can't really, you're not going to be able to predict which strategy to take, but you could still have a historical analysis to see where your particular society is going or where your social needs are going. And I was thinking about some very worrying developments in American political philosophy. I was thinking about the very interesting American political philosopher Martha Nussbaum, mm-hmm. and her frontiers of justice idea. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I kind of would buy into her ideas if I knew where they were going.
Right.
Like, she wants to reform things, but she doesn't say where. Or how. She just has mm-hmm. various desires that.
Yeah, I was recently reading that book, and I found myself agreeing with a number of the concerns and finding her very, very naive about what sort of institutional forms would reliably actually bring about some of those reforms.
So I was trying to think, what if one applied some Spencerian constraints on her ideas, then you could kind of make them more plausible and possibly acceptable. Like, and you know, like moral universalism is a very hard call, mm-hmm. and would tend to make us do nothing at all, really.
Yeah,
it's too crude. I thought that one could probably do some kind of a Spencerian job on people like her, mm-hmm. and basically have possibly less. She's actually quite interventionist in an imperial way herself.
Yes.
And for good reason, but the outcomes would be atrocious. And so I thought that Spencer would have some kind of future life as a person who could ride shotgun on some liberal and progressive ideas to make sure that they didn't go sour.
Well, that sounds great. Mark, I think we're running out of time. I think that might be a good place to end what Martha Nussbaum needs is a little more Herbert Spencer, which I think might be something that some of our viewers will need to grapple with further by reading your rich and fascinating book, Herbert Spencer and the Invention of Modern Life. Mark, thanks so much for coming on, and I hope you have a great rest of your day down in
thanks very
New
much.
Zealand.
Thanks very much, Will. It was good to talk to you.
It was great talking to you. Have a good one, Mark.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.